And...
sell your car now. Universal Motors, 2525 South Michigan, will pay America's highest prices only as long as war workers on the West Coast need cars. Listen, up to $1,100 for a 41 Chevrolet, $1,250 for a 41 Buick. Unbelievable, but true. Universal Motors is authorized to buy any car, 37s to 42s, whether fully paid for or not. Drive out or call Lucky Lincoln, Victory 2300. That's right, Lucky Lincoln, Victory 2300, Universal Motors.
WIND at 5 minutes past 8 o'clock.
We bring you at this time, by special transcription, a program heard earlier today over the Columbia Broadcasting System. Wrigley's Spearmint Gum brings you American Women. In wartime as in peacetime, America is thankful for the spirit of her women. Their courage, their ability, their willingness to be of service have been a strength to our nation since its earliest days. The makers of Wrigley Spearmint Gum are glad to use this radio time to pay tribute to our American women so that you can share with us our admiration for them. We're glad, too, that under the stress and tension of the times, many of you are finding Wrigley Spearmint Gum helpful in reducing strain and restlessness. So now, Wrigley's Spearmint Gum brings you American Women.
The smell of wet woolen clothing was thick in the crowded street car. The windows were blackly streaked and dripping with the slanting, steely rain. But Connie, thinking of Ken, hardly noticed. She was living again their last minute together in the station. Ken had been swell.
Look, sweetheart, you mustn't feel like that about it. Maybe they're right, you know. Maybe it is better to wait. I know you love me.
Better for whom? Better for what?
Better for you, darling. As far as I'm concerned, you belong to me. And I belong to you for keeps.
Oh, Ken.
And I'll keep feeling that way till I come back. Is that a deal, darling? Well, that settles it for us. Now, goodbye, Connie. I've got to kiss you, so you'll remember that, too, for a long time.
From the streetcar, she walked fast, facing the sharp, steady rain head on, thinking of Ken. She hesitated a moment, gathering courage, before opening the door to her home.
Is that you, Connie?
Any mail?
I put it on the table so you'd be sure to see it. But, Connie, you better get out of those wet clothes before you stop to read it. Oh, please, Connie, you'll catch your death of cold, and I'm making a nice big kettle of warm soup for dinner. I thought with weather like this... is something wrong? Connie, tell me. Connie, darling.
Read it. Read it.
Dear Con, I know it's been some time since I last wrote, and I hope you haven't worried. It hasn't been easy to write this letter. But, Connie, I've got to tell you something that's been on my mind. You know, and so do I, that you and I are kind of impulsive. We wanted to get married, I know I did, in the worst way. And you said you did, too. But I've had time to think it over. And, Con, I've decided your family was right to keep you from it. I'm sorry, but I know it will be for the best if we just call off the plans we made before I went away. Ken. Oh, Connie, it's awful for you.
Please, Mother, don't. I'm going upstairs. I don't want any help.
In the weeks that followed, Connie's parents had begun to tell each other that poor Connie was going to come out of it all right, though it would take time, maybe a long time. And she'd learn to smile and shrug and say, "Oh, that's all over," when people inquired solicitously about what she'd heard from Ken. Then one day, one of her friends at the office told her that she'd heard that Ken was in the Mackenzie Hospital outside of New York City, recovering from wounds he'd received in Sicily. The friend didn't know anything more about it than that, that Ken was convalescing and in Mackenzie. Connie couldn't remember later how she got through the rest of the day at the office. At home after work, she said nothing. But her parents, accustomed now to the small wooden smile and the stoical calm with which she went through the familiar motions of the day, sensed a new excitement running like living water under the quiet, frozen surface. They exchanged questioning looks, but neither spoke of the change to Connie. In her room that night, Connie wrote a letter.
"Dear Ken, you'll think I have no pride, and perhaps you're right. Pride is a frail and false thing to live by, compared with even the smallest hope. I learned today that you're at Mackenzie, and suddenly I knew how much I want to see you. I'll not make you uncomfortable or embarrass you in your new decision. I promise you that. All I need to hear is that you won't mind if I do come. Connie."
She wept a little over the shamelessness of it and over her happiness in writing it. Then she went out to mail it. His reply came promptly, a fact that even while she opened the envelope sang dizzily in her head.
"Dear Connie, I'm sorry. I think it would serve no good purpose to have you come. Thanks just the same. Ken."
It was only after the sobs had quieted and the first bitter shock of disappointment and humiliation was spent that Connie suddenly knew, as a person sometimes knows a thing without evidence, that this wasn't Ken. Not the Ken she'd loved. Not the Ken who had written her letters full of joyful plans for their future. Not the Ken whose words of love could fire her dreams across half the earth. She knew he had been wounded. And now she was convinced that... She guessed, not daring to speculate. Whatever it was, she had to find out. She went downstairs to the living room where her father was reading his evening paper while her mother hemmed some dish towels. Her voice was electric.
"Dad. Mother.
Connie.
I've just had a letter from Ken. He's in a hospital in New York. He doesn't want me, but I've got to go and see him."
"In a hospital?
Do you know what's happened to him?"
"I don't know, but I have to find out."
"But he doesn't want you. Why, Connie, where's your pride?"
"I guess maybe I haven't any, Dad. Maybe I'll be back here in a couple of days, ready to admit for the rest of my life that I've been a shameless fool. But I don't even care about that. I've got to go. I've got to see Ken and talk to him."
"I can't let you, Connie. You're my daughter and I..."
"I must go, Dad. And I'll be back. And then, whatever else has happened, I'll take it and I won't ever be shameless again."
When Connie told them at the hospital that she wanted to see Corporal Kenneth Haldane, she thought she noticed a moment of hesitancy. In that moment, she asked whether she might send him a note, and desperately she scribbled a couple of lines.
"I've come. I promise not to stay long or ever bother you again. Please talk to me. Connie."
The nurse took it, nodded silently, and left. Connie waited. She didn't know how much later it was when the nurse returned. But she knew instantly that she was to see Ken. He was standing up when she first saw him, and the first thing she noticed was the grim set of his jaw. And in the terrible intensity of the moment, it seemed to her as if he were waving his crutches, flaunting them purposely to frighten her. Then she looked at his face again, and all that she knew was that she loved him. Ken.
You shouldn't have come.
I had to, Ken.
It's useless. It only makes things worse.
Why?
It's not the way it used to be. Everything has changed.
Everything?
Yes.
You mean you no longer love me? Look at me and say that, Ken. And I'll go.
I... no longer. Oh, Connie, why did you come? I fixed it up so that you'd... Can't you see what I am? Cripple. You'll pity me. You're the kind of a person who'd keep her word about marrying a cripple.
Pity you? I don't know how badly you've been wounded, Ken, but I don't pity you.
You don't know I've lost a leg.
Oh, Ken, I'm ashamed of you.
Ashamed?
You think I should pity you because you lost a leg fighting in this war? You've given your leg in a war and a cause in which millions have given their lives. Yes, and the lives of those they loved. Do you think that whatever happened to you, the same thing didn't happen to me? Do you think I wouldn't be proud of our battle scars? Not yours. Ours. You don't know what a woman's love means, sir.
Connie. You don't pity me?
Please.
I believe you really do. Oh, Connie. Connie. You make a fool. Oh.
Ken. And so, like many another staunch American woman, Connie accepted her part of the burden of the war. In this and in many other small and large ways, the women of America will have earned their share in victory.
Today, Wrigley's Spearmint Gum has brought you the experience of another American woman who is helping her country in time of crisis. In bringing you these programs, we'd like you to know that we are doing our level best to supply Wrigley's Spearmint Gum wherever it is needed. Millions of people, millions more than ever before, are chewing gum to help relieve nervous tension, keep the mouth moist, and to get comfort while they work. And they especially want Wrigley's Spearmint Gum for its lively, refreshing, real spearmint flavor and its delicious chewing quality. So we are making all the Wrigley's Spearmint Gum we can make and still maintain its high quality.
Ella Collins, who was along in years, tended the canteen in the railroad station at Fort Junction every night to have a bite ready for the soldiers. And she was happy doing it, night after night. The station master couldn't quite make it out.
It's sure amazing. Person like you that's got nothing in the war and nobody. Person that's got enough to live on. Coming down night after night to cheer up a couple of soldiers. How come? Now, if you had boys of your own riding them trains, maybe a person could see how, but this way...
I guess I don't know myself. I guess I'm just filling in time, Mr. Richards. I guess it's because nobody exactly needs me, you see. And down here, sometimes, for just a minute, I get the feeling that some of them need me.
Thank you for listening today. We hope you will listen tomorrow at this same time. to learn of Mrs. Collins' meeting with a soldier as lonely as she was, when we bring you another tribute to American women.